Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 3rd, 2010, and this is show number 280. Well, today is a very, very special day for the NoSilla castaways. Good friend of the show, Pat Mon, who's been on the show before, he was on once talking about MiFi options available in Europe. He came to the NoSilla Castaways party in Macworld, so a lot of us got to meet him. And he met us at the Tweet Up in Ireland. And I got to tell you, he has had a genuine miracle in his life, and I think all of the NoSilla Castaways are tearing up at what happened today. When we met Pat in Ireland, he very quietly told Steve and I about the challenges he's having raising an autistic son. Pat's son is 7 years old, and he doesn't speak. It turns out there's a communications method called PECS. It stands for Picture Exchange Communication System. It's a little book of pictures on Velcro that autistic people apparently can resonate to a little bit, and they take and stick these pieces of Velcro on a page in a row to make a sentence. He does use it some, but barely at all. He really hasn't taken to it. So he's completely shut off from the world because he does not speak. Today, Pat was taking him out of the bathtub. He pointed at Pat to get his attention, and then he said, "Want pad." You see, Pat's son has an iPad, and he wanted it from the other room. Pat's son spoke his very first words in 7 years. 7 years. He's 7 years old. He's never spoken. And it was to tell his dad, "I want my iPad." You know, it's impossible to say this, to hear this, to think about this without having chills every time you think of it. The joy that Pat and his family must be feeling at this incredible breakthrough. And you got to say, what an amazing thing that his first words were about the iPad. I know Steve Jobs says the iPad is magical. And I have to say that you got to kind of believe him. There is something about this that's getting down to a root level in all of us. The even better news is that Pat's son went on throughout the day to say Dada, Mom, and his own name. He almost said Mark. He said Mar. Can you even imagine what that was like? This is truly a miraculous day. I mean, if you could see the chat room now, I mean, everyone is tearing up in the chat room, and we're all feeling a big virtual hug for an amazing day in the NoSilla Castaway family, and most importantly, in Pat's family. Well, yesterday, Steve and I had a really fun adventure. We went to the Orange Apple Computer Club so that I could give a presentation on podcasting. The way I got invited was interesting. In 1989, I worked with a guy named Greg Locke, who was the Mac guru for our engineering group. Unfortunately, he left the company a year or two later, and he's been off on other adventures for the last 20 years or so. A couple of months ago, he was fooling around on the web, and he found the All Things D video of the Steve Jobs interview, and much to his surprise, there was Allison Sheridan at the very end asking Steve a question. I actually really like the way Greg tells the story, because he says, "I didn't look any different than I did 20 years ago." You know, he's a very, very intelligent and observant man. Anyway, he asked me if I'd come speak, and I said yes. As I've explained before, I didn't learn how to do this podcasting thing all on my own by reading books. Although I did start with a book called Podcasting, The Do-It-Yourself Guide by Todd Cochran. It was written way back in 2005, one of the earliest books, and it really did help me get started. But most of what I learned, someone gave of their free time to teach me how to do it. I can't begin to remember everyone who helped me figure it out. The lesson I did learn, though, was that I had to pay it forward whenever I could. That's why I created the Podcasting and Podcasting series, and that's why I agree to speak at events like this, this user group, whenever I can. Now, the audience, while not necessarily filled with people who dream of the fame and, you know, obvious fortune of becoming a podcaster, they did listen intently and they asked lots of great questions. I think my favorite, though, was at the very end when a woman asked me, "Do you slow down when you do your podcast? Because you talk really fast." I had to laugh, and then I told her about Connor P., who actually listens to the show at double speed. Her eyes got real big, and I don't think she believed me. You know, it's easy as geeks to get into doing everything online and never go out into meet space. And I'm right there with you. I mean, I'd rather, text somebody or email somebody than ever talk on the phone, much less go out in person. But, you know, whenever I do, I have a great time. And I really enjoy getting to meet these people who enjoy the Mac and all the other Apple goodies we like so much. I highly recommend jumping out of your comfort zone just once in a while at least to go to a user group and meet some fine people who enjoy the Mac. Thanks, Greg, for a fabulous day. A while ago, I did an extensive study of 4 ebook readers on the iPad and other devices. After careful consideration, a highly technical analysis using quality functional deployment techniques, I declared the Amazon Kindle app to be the winner. I thought it might be a good idea to do a short revisit of the topic because I actually have read a couple of books on a few of them since then. Based on the vast number of people who had recommended Daemon, or Daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, I bought it on the Borders ebook reader for the iPad. First of all, I did not like this book at all. Sure, it had lots of clever references to the high-tech stuff we like, but there were too many characters, too many separate plot lines that never came together, and a completely unsatisfying ending. I'm not going to spoil it for you by telling you, but, you might be asking, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? But the fact that I didn't like the book, Daemon, is not the topic of my discussion today. The Borders app did come in dead last in the pack of 4 apps, but it was worse than I even gave it credit for. First of all, when you open the book, it shows you where you are. Great! But then it repaints the screen. Why does it do that? It doesn't need to. It's not a huge deal, but it's kind of jarring to the senses when it does it. Next, you have to figure out where you were, because it's pretty much always wrong on remembering where you were in the book. You have to go to bookmarks, then scroll through every bookmark you've made. I understand it's handy to be able to make a note on a page when you're doing research, but if you're just reading a darn novel, you only need one bookmark. Why should I have to scroll through a ton of bookmarks just to start reading? How about having a highlight feature and bookmark as a separate thing? The other thing is the pages turn really slowly. It was so bad that I started turning pages before I was done reading, which was not a good idea because it would be a little faster than I was reading. When I finally slogged through the disappointing book Daemon, I started reading Under the Dome by Stephen King on the Amazon Kindle app, which did win the QFD analysis as the best ebook reader. I had sent out a tweet before my vacation asking for book recommendations, and I really wish I could remember who recommended it because I'm really enjoying it, of course, in a creepy, scary kind of way. Anyway, you have no idea what a relief it was to use the Kindle app instead of Borders. I wasn't even sure how much I hated the Borders app till I went to the Kindle app again. The pages turn virtually instantaneously, and bookmarks work perfectly. I mean, every time I open the book, it's right where I left off. Basically, it works just like you want it to. Pick up your iPhone instead of your iPad, and it politely informs you that you're not at the furthest location. Would you like to be? Tap yes, and you're right where you left off on the iPad. I know these are small things, but it's sort of like having someone stop rubbing the same spot on your arm over and over and over again. I feel calm and free to immerse myself in the book. I just wish I knew how this would all turn out for the people under the dome. Oh my God, you guys are not going to believe this. That is crazy listener James over my shoulder. Anyone who's listening right now is not getting this, but the people in the chat room, this is crazy listener James is in my house.
Hello.
Talk to them.
Greetings, No Silly Castaways. How are you?
Why are you in my house?
Because I felt like surprising you.
It was so creepy.
Hey, at least we talked him out of the chainsaw.
Yeah, he left the chainsaw at home this time. That's good to hear.
Well, wait, I want to do what every single one of your viewers and listeners wants to do.
What? Oh, get it off me. Get it off me. He's hugging me. Oh, dear. Oh, that's just horrid. Okay, right. I'm going to stop the recording for a second here. All right. I have my self pulled back together a little bit. That was a frightening experience. I still can't believe he did that. I wondered when Steve tweeted this afternoon that there were going to be hijinks involved in today's show, but I did not know quite what that was. Having crazy listener James in my house is... Was a terrifying thing. I liked what Rose said in the chat room. She said, I was hoping I was the only one who ever got to be in the only Nocilla castaway who got to be in your bedroom. Well, technically, I think I let Steve in from time to time. Into the studio, we should call it. Yes, the studio. Anyway, let's keep the show going.
Allison was feeling a bit under the weather last week, so she asked if I wouldn't mind recording the following email exchange between us for the show. You bet. Anything to help out our favoritest podcaster. So one afternoon, I wrote the following. Hey, Allison. Man, I miss being at the live show. I gotta get my schedule worked out. I missed 2 in a row, and that's just unacceptable. The live chat room is better entertainment than most anything you can do for free, and a lot of things that cost money. You're still with me, though. Today, I thought about how smart you are. I'm working on a project and trying to set up a site to both serve those interested in information and myself with some affiliate sales if possible in a niche. And for those across the way, like Oz Rose, it's also called niche. We must be culturally correct after all. Actually, I'm still testing the market to see if there's any future in it. Anyway, I have several keywords to choose from and couldn't decide on which was best and in which order to pursue them. There are many factors, such as how many people are searching for a thing, how much competition there is for it, etc. Hey, didn't Allison and Steve talk about something? Yeah, what was it they called it? Some engineering geeky term. Oh yeah, it's in the show notes from the Book Reader episode number 272. It was a QFD, quick formula dysfunction, or something like that. Anyway, here goes. This is the most important thing, so I'll give it 100. This other thing's a 75, and this other one's a 70. Now, two numbers are close, but the other one... Oh, yeah, I'll just divide by 10,000 to get it in the same range. X times A plus Y, whatever, equals score! So it's true. Listening to the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, does actually make you smarter. Now I have to go make a screen steps of this, so don't forget it. Thanks, Al. Then she replied,
by the way, the QFD thing depends on the 139 weighting and the 139 value. It's the main trick that makes the right answer pop out.
Okay, whatever. No, seriously. That's the one thing I love about you, Allison, is that you're always willing to share what you know with anyone willing to listen. And sometimes those who aren't, but that's okay. She also wrote,
it's so cool how much people enjoy the chat room. Me yapping on the screen is just an excuse for you guys to get together and hang out. Bart was just talking to me about how he likes that it's safe for the kids and grown-ups. No fighting, no sniping, just people ready to have fun and care about each other.
It was a bad email connection, as you can tell from the quality. I wrote back and said, thanks for the 139 tip. I'll have to read up on it. Guess my thing was just a normal weighted rank and not an engineer geeky one. The Mac community is special, and the NoSillaCast community even more so. You attract good folks, Allison. At this time, she went into full-scale alert mode. It was a red alert across the board, and she sent me a spreadsheet example of how the QFD stuff works and told me people make their lives around this stuff. That was just too much for me to take. What kind of people wrap themselves around math and formulas and stupid stuff like... Hi, Steve and Allison. What's happening? So I'm going on the record saying what I did at the start, that it's true. Listening to the NoSillaCast podcast actually does make you smarter. Thanks, Allison. We love you.
That was really nice, Jim. The NoSilla Castaways loved hearing that in the live chat room, so that was good as well. I love how I got into your head. Keep up the good work and let me know how your quick formula dysfunction works out. Hey, did Jim just mention screen steps? Why, yes, I think he did. Perhaps one reason he did that was because I'm in his head, or perhaps he really does think of using screen steps when he wants to remember something. Yeah, I was sitting here trying to think of all the different ways I've tried to use screen steps to solve problems, or successfully use screen steps to solve problems, I should say. Sure, I use it to make brilliant tutorials for other people to help them be more productive, but there's so many more uses. I use it when someone's giving a presentation, say over a telecon, and they're doing a screen share, and I would want to remember a page they're showing without waiting for them to remember to send me the diagram or slide. I use it when I'm taking an online class and I know the tricky bit I'm reading will be important later, maybe during the test. And so I just grab some quick snaps with screen steps and I name the lesson, maybe give it a tag or two, and I can always get back to it. Lots of times I use screen steps when I'm doing something difficult and I'm afraid I'm going to forget what I did and not remember in a month or two how to reproduce it. Windows or Mac, for others or for yourself, for official training and help desk documentation, or for silly little things you just want to remember, screen steps does it brilliantly and easily. $40 for the standard version or $80 for the pro version. But of course, you get 25% off that price if you use the coupon code NoSilla, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, over at screensteps.com. Well, now I'm going to tell you a long and sordid tale. A tale that starts out with the purchase of an Apple TV from our friend Pat Dengler, otherwise known as YourMacDoctor.com. I won't go through all of the gruesome details of that adventure, but the main reason it wasn't the best experience is that it couldn't do one of the main things Steve wanted to do with it. That was to play content outside of iTunes. For example, he wanted to be able to play our home movie DVD disc images, and also web content like the live NoSillaCast on Ustream. When Jonathan Cost finally offered me $50 to take it off my hands if I just shut the heck up about it, we took his offer. It was a steal for him, but the comedy was worth it, and we went out and got a Mac Mini. Now, you probably think that since you haven't heard much about the Mac Mini, it's all been going along swimmingly. Well, that's not exactly the case. For some reason, this Mac Mini decided that it would play any Flash content we wanted as long as it wasn't the live show on Ustream, or even a recorded show on Ustream. This made no sense at all. We reinstalled Flash, but it still didn't work. We had Pat over to work her magic. She reinstalled Flash, but it still didn't work. This was a serious mystery. Over the months, I'd try again, a new version of Flash would come out, so ever hopeful, I'd try again, but it still didn't work. Finally, Pat got tired of hearing me whine about it and suggested I just reinstall OS X, especially since we didn't keep any content to speak of on that device or even any applications to speak of. So a couple of weekends ago, I got out my Snow Leopard disk and I went to work on reinstalling. As I went through the menus, I kept an eagle eye out for that button that says, customize or something like that, so I could choose to wipe the disk and start over. It never came up. The reinstall was actually an archive and install, leaving everything in place, including, you got it, a non-functioning Flash player when I was on the Ustream website. Back to bothering Pat, and she reminded me that Apple moved that option. Now, when you're booted into the install disk, you open the Utilities menu at the top and choose Disk Utility. I said, what menu at the top? Turns out, there's supposed to be a menu bar up there, but for the life of me, I couldn't find it. Off to the Googles to try and figure out why I wasn't seeing the whole screen, and eventually I was reminded that there's this feature called Overscan. I don't actually understand exactly what this is or why you have to mess with it, but on the display preferences, you have to turn Overscan on and then figure out what the heck your TV manufacturer calls it, and then figure out where the heck that your TV manufacturer put it in their convoluted menus. Trust me, it's not under display or even like picture. Using the Googles again, we figured out for our TV, it was called Full Pixels under some buried menu somewhere. Huzzah! We can see Disk Utility now and we can scrape the disk. First thing we did when we booted it up was open a Safari window and make sure Ustream video played on it. And it did. This was really good. Hot dogs, we're cooking now. We're gonna get this thing done. We're cracking the code. We ran all the software updates, and when all that was done, we noticed that the resolution wasn't quite right. This is where, if I were capable of appreciating music, I would drop in some ominous, foreshadowy music because things go terribly bad right around now. I went into Display Preferences on the Mac Mini, and in looking through the screen resolutions, nothing jumped out at me as the perfect option. I was hoping to see something like 1080p, but it wasn't there. I chose some resolution that was something close to 1080 lines. I think it was like maybe 1280 by 720 or something like that. But it doesn't matter, because the instant I hit apply, the screen went black and the AV receiver displayed a message saying it wasn't supported. I didn't freak out, though. No problem, because all computers, even Windows computers, always revert back to a working resolution in 10 or 20 seconds if you don't hit OK or apply or whatever. Not that day. Crescendos and ominous music happens here. So after a few non-Girl Scout safe words were said by your hero, I figured I'd just dash up and grab my trusty old 1024 by 768 19-inch HP LCD monitor, plug that bad boy in, fix things right up. I need to take a pause here to explain a piece. This is going to be important. This is kind of critical. We have a fancy pants AV receiver that sends HDMI into our TV. So we have high quality audio and video. You know, it's all really important. This AV receiver has five HDMI in ports. Now, we don't have the brand new model of Mac Mini that supports HDMI, though. Instead, it has a mini display port for video, and the audio is available either via the digital audio mini jack or via USB. So I bought a little adapter from monoprice.com, cost me hardly nothing, it was $25, something like that. It takes the USB and mini display ports, mashes them together in some electronics, and it goes into HDMI into the receiver. It's been working for quite some time, in spite of the flash problem, it's been working just fine. From now on, I'm going to call that adapter the MonoPrice adapter instead of saying mini display port to USB to HDMI adapter. We'll just call it the MonoPrice adapter. All right, so back to where we were. We're about to plug in the HP monitor. In order to do that, though, since it's a VGA monitor, I had to swap out the MonoPrice device for a DisplayPort to VGA adapter, which, of course, I also bought from MonoPrice.com. I was able to instantly see everything on screen just fine from the HP LCD monitor. That's when I realized that OS X is very clever, and it remembers what monitor you plugged in, so it reverts to whatever you told it last for that particular monitor. That means using a second monitor to diagnose the problem was no use at all in fixing the problem. So next up, I thought maybe we should skip the MonoPrice adapter to eliminate it as a root cause. I should mention that a week or so before this happened, I'd been messing with the MonoPrice adapter and the case sort of cracked on it. So I'd kind of glued it back together and I thought maybe it was the culprit and the resolution change had just been a coincidental event. So I plugged from the Mac Mini into, I put a DisplayPort to HDMI adapter in place. So now there's no electronics combining the audio and video. I'm just sending video from the Mini DisplayPort out to HDMI straight into the TV. Guess what? It worked fine. The Mac Mini was displayed on the big screen, and when I checked the resolution, I now saw 1080p with overscan on. Okay, at this point, I'm thinking that MonoPrice adapter was looking like it was the root of all my problems. I mean, heck, it was broken recently. So luckily, Pat came yet again to my rescue and told me she had a MonoPrice adapter just like mine that I could have if I wanted. She even dropped it off. I really do owe her dinner. Maybe she's really trying to get me to quit whining. Anyway, we tried it out, and it didn't work. Now we were really baffled. I started tweeting out the problem, but it was hard to be clear and thorough in 140 characters. I got a lot of suggestions from a lot of people, but when they were answering me, I was actually watching a movie, so I didn't get a chance to try those right that minute. So this morning, Steve and I attacked the problem yet again. This time we had a new idea. Remember I said that the Mac Mini has a digital audio mini jack also? So we thought, what if we just did the video part using the straight HDMI adapter, which works just fine, but then we run the audio out of that mini jack into the AV receiver? This should actually work. It was time to stop trying to figure out what actually went wrong and fix it. We just bypassed the whole problem. The downside of this problem is that means pulling the AV receiver out and getting to the back of it to add the 278th cable to the back of it. We have so many things going in and out of that. The cable bundle is like 4 inches in diameter, and the hole it goes through is about 4 1/32 of an inch in diameter. I mean, it's really, really tight. So when you pull on the AV receiver, it invariably yanks one of the cables out that you didn't want to unplug, and then you take a half an hour and trying to figure out where it should go, and there's a lot of swearing and sweating involved. It's not good. I keep begging Steve, one of these days we need to just pull the whole thing out, cut a giant hole in the back of the cabinet so we wouldn't always dread trying to pull that darn receiver out. Anyway, the other problem was even if we were willing to do that, we would need to get our hands on a cable that would go from optical mini jack to Toslink, which is the audio cable standard on the AV receiver. Of course, MonoPrice had it for $3.28 and we could get it in a couple of days, but we really wanted it right now. So we searched Best Buy, Radio Shack, and even Apple, and none of them had one in stock. So we're sitting there. What is it we're going to do? Back to square one. We called Katie Floyd on Faceplant, and I enjoyed meeting her mother, which was really fun, and we started noodling ideas with her. That's when I remembered something I had read. I'd been searching the Apple forums, and it was also tweeted to me by Steve Gibbon. Steve suggested I use screen sharing to control the Mac Mini while it was still connected to the TV by the MonoPrice adapter. See, this was the way we could actually see it in its native form, even though we can't see it in its true native form. I figured we couldn't lose at this point, so with the straight HDMI adapter plugged in, we opened the sharing preference pane and enabled screen sharing. Then we reconnected the MonoPrice adapter one more time. I launched screen sharing from the Finder sidebar on the Mac Mini, and I got right in. So now, for the first time in 2 weeks, I could finally see how the display settings were set. Would you believe it was indeed set to 1080p, even though I swear to you it wasn't there when I went to select it, but instead of having the US standard 60Hz NTSC chosen, it was set to the 50Hz PAL setting for Europe. I flipped it over to NTSC, and bam, up comes the Mac Mini on the TV. I told you this was a long and sordid tale filled with intrigue and mystery and a host of players involved in the plot. As I accept the award for Best Dramatic Storytelling, I would like to thank Kirshen, Victor Cahiao, Balding Nerd, Mark Shepard, RQC, XXLoverXX, and Greg Harbin for their help on Twitter. Of course, Katie Floyd for help and moral support on Faceplant, Pat Dengler for the email support, Twitter support, phone support, and even physical support dropping off the adapter, and of course, Steve Gibbon for the winning answer of using screen sharing to solve the problem. This was a great adventure, but I am so glad that it's finally solved. Oh, and yes, we did check after all of this to make sure Ustream still works. Well, I'm a little bit bummed out right now because a young man wasn't paying attention on the road this week, and he plowed right into Honda Bob while he was stopped at a stop sign. That pushed Honda Bob into the car in front of him, totaling his Honda Element. And you got to realize, wrecking Bob's car is wrecking his entire mechanic shop. I suppose the good news is neither Bob nor the young man nor the person in front of Bob were injured, but his red Element is no more. It was totaled. The weird thing is that this is the third time in 15 months that Honda Bob has been rear-ended. Now, you might be wondering, maybe this is his fault, but how is it your fault if you're stopped at a red light? What are you supposed to be doing? I don't know why people keep rear-ending him. Luckily, this time, like I said, he wasn't injured. The good news is that he's getting a Honda Pilot next week, and that should give him even more room to work and carry tools, so it might be a better solution overall. I bet he's going to have a blast getting it all set up, you know, like us getting a new computer. It's kind of a pain in some ways because you kind of wish you didn't have to stop and take all that time, but it's kind of fun in other ways. I'm sure glad Honda Bob is okay because over the past 30-plus years, he's become a good friend to Steve and I. Even our children, you know, adore him. He's kind of like Uncle Bob. If you live in the L.A. or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. I hear you were out chasing trains today, Bart.
I was indeed. I haven't processed them yet, but I think I got some shots. The weather wasn't entirely cooperative, but then again, it is Ireland and it is October, so I guess that's to be expected.
You're lucky you were outside, right?
Well, actually, yeah, look, I didn't get rained on.
Well, let's see. We have a couple of things on the agenda for today. As always, we got to start out with Security Light. Eat our vegetables first. What's on the ticket today?
This is a modern Nouvelle Cuisine version of Security Light. We have 1P, or in this case, an out-of-band patch from Microsoft for their .NET framework, which affects many, many versions of Windows. XP, Vista, Server 2003, Server 2008, and that last one should say Windows 7 in the show notes, but it says Vista again.
Okay, so, all right, good. Yeah, I noticed my machine rebooted on Tuesday, and I sat there thinking, Bart didn't tell me it was Patch Tuesday coming up. It's funny, I know things just because of what you tell me, because I don't pay attention to anything else.
Well, it's out of band. Now, they had announced it before last weekend, but I've been trying to figure out how this bug affects ordinary people, and I still haven't been able to answer that question, which is why I didn't bring it up last week, because last week it was a problem without a solution.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out how it affected people. I'm still not sure it affects anyone but servers, because it's a bug in their .NET framework, which affects if you communicate with it over an SSL secured web connection, from what I can tell. Which I don't think people do on their home machines. But anyway, the .NET framework is used by lots of things, so maybe it does affect people somehow.
Ah, okay. So what's Adobe got for us this week?
Nothing I could find, which makes me suspicious always.
Has it ever been true, right?
Yeah, once or twice.
All right. Well, and nothing about Java, nothing stupid from Apple?
Not that made the news anyway.
Wow, that is a single pea in our vegetables.
It's a single pea. Definitely Nouvelle Cuisine.
I like it. I like it. All right. Well, I asked Bart if he would help me out with something here this week. This is another great example of why I named my show in a way you can't possibly say I'm off topic. So I won't say this is off topic, but I have a lot of interest in scientific sort of stuff in general. And I've been hearing on a lot of podcasts, they've been yapping about some planet that's been discovered that could potentially sustain life. But then they just kind of move on from that. They talk about the name and then they move along and they go, oh, isn't that adorable? Well, I'd like a little more depth. I'd like to understand what was actually discovered and why is this important? What is so different from what we knew before? And so, and I also want to say, when I went to Ireland, a lot of people said, what surprised you when you met Bart? And I'm going to embarrass him a little bit here. And what surprised me was I knew that Bart had an incredible amount of technical depth in the stuff we talk about on the show, and Unix and Linux and Mac and networks and all and security and this sort of thing. But what I didn't realize was his depth in so many different subjects. And one of them happens to be astronomy. So I thought, hey, maybe I could get Bart to explain this to me, and maybe you guys would enjoy listening to it too.
Okay, now that I'm done blushing.
I know you hate that, but sorry, it had to be said.
It's an Irish thing. We don't take praise well.
Well, you do have quite an interest in astronomy, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's how I got over my fear of the dark.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah, I used to be scared to go to the dark. And then my uncle taught me astronomy, and now I just spend all my time outside in the dark looking up going, ooh, isn't it pretty?
That's neat. That's a cool story. I like it. I wonder if anybody else could use that with their kids.
Yeah, now the nice thing, of course, is when I grew up in rural Ireland, we could actually see the Milky Way because light pollution wasn't an issue, except maybe a little bit near the horizon on the direction of our local town, but that was it. So for the rest, you know, we had an uninterrupted view of the sky whenever the weather allowed.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I do miss that. Living in LA, we have to drive about 200 miles before we can see the Milky Way, I think.
Which is tragic because it's such a beautiful sight.
Oh, it really is.
But anyway. So this week, news broke about a planet. Now, the pronunciation for this one is very wildly different depending on who you ask. Some people call it Gliese, some people call it Gliese. But since it's a German name, I have been reliably informed it's Gliese.
Gliese, okay.
So, yeah. The star is Gliese 581G. Which is a wonderfully descriptive name. So, where did that name come from?
Does that mean they found 580 other Gliese's?
No. Gliese was a German astronomer, and he compiled a list of stars that are physically close to the sun. And he catalogued them and gave them numbers. So Gliese anything is from his catalog. So this is the 581st star in his catalog. And then the lowercase g means that it is the 6th planet discovered. And you may say, hang on a sec, shouldn't it be the 7th?
Well, wait. There's 581 stars he catalogued.
Yes, so this is the 581st star in his catalogue.
Okay.
Around which is orbiting 6 planets. And the one we're interested in is the 6th of those discovered, which is called Gliese 581G, or GJ 581G, to really go nerdy on it.
Okay. All right.
And the reason, right, so this is, you might think G would be the 7th planet.
Oh, is that the 7th letter in the alphabet?
Yeah.
Okay.
But they don't use A because that might get confusing. So you can consider the star itself to be A.
Ah, okay.
And then the first planet is B, second planet is C, third planet is D, and so on. So we're up to G in this little star system here.
Now, is Gliese still alive, or is this people have carried on his work?
I don't know if he's still alive, but his catalogue dates from the 50s.
Okay.
So if he was... Yeah, he published his catalogue in 1957.
Oh, wow. So this is probably people carrying on the work in the numbering system?
Okay, well, the numbering system for planets is you call them after their star with a lowercase letter after it.
Oh, okay.
So the reason this planet is called GJ581G is because the star was already called GJ581.
Okay.
So if the star was called something else from a different catalog, you would prefix that other name with B, C, D, E, F.
Okay.
So the reason you find a lot of planets around Gliese stars is because we like to look for planets on stars that are physically close to us, A, because it's easier, and B, because it's more interesting.
Okay.
So a lot of the planets will be around objects that are Gliese something. But we're using an old catalog from the 50s because, well, it's still correct.
Sure, why not? Okay.
So what we can tell from the name is that it's going around a star that's close to us that was in Gliese's catalog, and it's the sixth star we found there.
No, the sixth planet. Okay.
So what about Gliese 581? where is it? It's about 20 light years away.
Oh, it's not very far.
Which is not very far in terms of, you know, astronomical distances.
Right.
Of course, it's many, many millions of billions of trillions of miles. But
it's a long road trip. But
it's a very long road trip. But at the same time, in the grand scheme of things within the universe, it really is our next door neighbor. Yeah. There's only a handful of stars closer than that.
Not 580 closer?
I don't think he ranked them in terms of their closeness. I think he ranked them or found them.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Then, as seen from us, from the Earth, it would be in the constellation of Libra, and its brightness is magnitude 10.5.
Is that bright
now
or dim?
No. Dim.
Okay.
So the way the magnitude system works, we got it from the Greeks, and it's a bit funny, and it's based off the number 6, because the Greeks just love the number 6. So you take the brightest stars in the sky, and you call them first magnitude, and you take the dimmest stars you can see with your eyes, and you call them 6th magnitude.
Okay. So minus 10 would be really dim?
No, it's plus 10.
Plus 10.
So 0 bright, 6 dimmest we can see with our eye, we've gone to 10.
Ah.
So you won't even catch it in a pair of binoculars, because a pair of binoculars will cut you off at about 8.
Okay.
You're talking a fairly decent backyard telescope to see it at all.
Okay.
Now, this should tell you something, because it's only 20 light years away and it's so bloody dim. This is a teeny, weeny, tiny little star.
Oh, okay.
It's a red dwarf star, so it's not very bright in real terms.
So I don't actually know how big our sun is, so is that smaller than ours?
Our sun is, significantly. Significantly, okay. And significantly less powerful.
Than ours?
Yes, and okay. We'll put it into context in a minute.
Okay.
If you're interested in seeing it on a map, the SkyGazer software for the iPad has it listed. And some other software have it listed too, but they'll have it listed under potentially a couple of different names. A common name is also Wolf 562, because Wolf also made a catalogue of nearby objects.
Okay.
So Wolf 562 is the same star as Gliese 581.
All right.
So if you're curious, and if you have a telescope, you can point at it and say, look, 6 planets there. On the teeny tiny little spot. So I guess the question is, what's so interesting about this? I suppose the first thing to say that's interesting about it is this whole star system is pretty interesting, because all the planets, all 6 of them at least there are, and there could be more we haven't found yet, are going around in nice, circular, steady orbits. A lot of the stuff we found has been very extreme, where you have massively elliptical orbits and giant planets really close into their star. And those kind of systems, they're not stable enough for life to possibly evolve, because it's just chaos there.
Why is it chaotic? Because they're too close?
Well, if you have giant big planets that are 5 or 6 times the size of Jupiter careening in and out of your solar system at a very oblique angle, so it's not a circular orbit, it's a highly elliptical orbit, that's going to disrupt everything.
Oh, okay.
So all your orbits are constantly being knocked about, so that, you know, you might settle down into a good climate where you have liquid water for 1,000 years, and then, you know, the thing comes around again and bumps you out, and then you don't anymore, and before you know it, you're in the star, or you've ejected the solar system altogether.
I mean, I hate when that happens.
It happens a lot, actually. Planets can get ejected when things get a bit chaotic.
And when you say a bump, you mean they got so close that the gravitational forces whipped them out of place?
Yeah, it will be gravity rather than physically twatting into each other. But
okay, good.
You know, yeah, gravity. You know, Jupiter has a very big influence in our solar system, and these things are way bigger than Jupiter. And Jupiter, of course, is in a nice circular orbit here, so it causes a bit of chaos around the asteroid belt. But other than that, it does sort of acts as a shield almost to stop stuff coming in and annoying us. So a lot of the other stuff we found has been really extreme planets. So when you have planets that big in such mad orbits, you know, you don't have a stable climate on the planet. There's no room for little rocky planets for us to be on, because they get knocked out of the way. And also, these giant planets are almost certainly going to be gas giants. They're very, very, very unlikely to be solid.
Okay.
So they're not that interesting from the point of view of looking for life.
So if they're big, they're usually gas giants?
If they're many times Jupiter or many times Saturn, then you're really into gas giant. And even if they're about the size of Jupiter or Saturn, you're still probably talking gas giant.
Okay.
So what's nice about this is that we have nice stable orbits for all 6 of the planets we know about. A lot of them are giants, but GJ581G is only 3 times the weight of the Earth, 3 times the mass of the Earth.
Hmm.
So that's probably too small to be a gas giant. It's bigger than the Earth, obviously, but not, you know, orders of magnitude bigger, just three times bigger. So on the grand scheme of things, that's a very small planet for us to have found so far away, and it's probably made of rock. So it's probably solid. And we know it's in a nice circular orbit, and it's in the so-called Goldilocks zone.
Ah.
So if you have a planet too close to the sun, you can't have liquid water because it will boil off. If you have a planet too far away, you can't have liquid water because it will freeze. But if you're just between those two extremes, it's just right, and you have a Goldilocks planet like this one.
Hmm. So now, it can
have liquid water. It doesn't mean it does have liquid water, just to say that. Okay.
Okay. On. I do want to know what that. I want to ask questions about that. But why did we just find this? If this was something that was discovered in 1957, the sun.
No.
Why did we just discover?
The star was discovered in 1957.
Right. But why did we not know there was a planet there?
Because it's really, really difficult to find planets around other stars. We'll go into that in a little bit.
Okay.
Because how we find these things is very cool. They're immensely difficult to find. We have trouble seeing asteroids that go around our sun, and they're very, 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 very close to us. They're not 20 light years away.
Hmm. Okay.
Pluto, we can't even see with the naked eye. It's in our solar system.
Yeah, that's true.
It takes a big telescope to see Pluto.
But it's not really a planet anyway.
No, but it's... You can't see Uranus or Neptune.
I don't want to bring up that whole kettle of fish. So now you jump to water, but what? Why would we even vaguely think it had water versus anything else?
Well, it's not that we think it has; it's that we know it can have,
because
which is very unusual because it's in the Goldilocks zone. It's at an appropriate distance from its star that the temperature is such that water can be liquid.
Oh, I just got why they call it the Goldilocks zone. It's
not
just
too hot,
right.
Not too cold. Yeah, exactly.
That's
now,
awesome.
Being in the Goldilocks zone doesn't mean you have water. It means you can have water. Because around our sun, there are three planets in the Goldilocks zone. Venus, Earth, and Mars. Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect, which means that although it could have liquid water if it didn't have a runaway greenhouse effect, it does have a runaway greenhouse effect, so it's a couple of hundred degrees Celsius on the surface.
So by greenhouse effect, you mean it doesn't have enough atmosphere to protect it?
No, too much atmosphere full of greenhouse gases.
Oh.
So it traps more heat than it radiates back out, so it's constantly heating up. Same problem with greenhouse effect.
So they have cows on the planet making methane? Oh, okay, let's not go down there. Okay.
No, they have methane, though. They have a lot of methane in the atmosphere.
Oh, okay.
It's not coming from cows unless they can... I mean, it rains sulfuric acid there. Not a pleasant place.
Nice vacation.
But it's in the Goldilocks
spot,
zone.
Okay.
Mars is also in the Goldilocks zone, but it has no atmosphere at all. Well, it doesn't have no atmosphere, but its atmosphere is so thin it can't hold on to any heat.
Okay.
So if Mars had an atmosphere, it could have liquid water and we could live there, but it doesn't.
Didn't we find ice there, though?
Yes, we have ice, but ice on Mars, ice sublimates. So it goes from solid straight to gas.
Oh, okay.
Because the pressure's too low.
Thanks for explaining that. I know I was supposed to remember what that was from chemistry in high school, but...
Yeah, so it's like dry ice here on the Earth. There's no such thing as liquid dry ice. It's either ice or that cool smoke you see in rock concerts, but it's never liquid.
Okay.
So we don't know for certain it has water, but it's the first time we found a planet which is in a stable solar system about the size of Earth, give or take a little bit, i.e. a factor of 3. So it's probably rocky, and it's in the right place for potentially having liquid water. So that makes it quite special.
And we haven't seen this ever before outside of our solar system?
No. The whole concept of exoplanets is immensely new. We've theorized about them for a century.
Wait, exoplanet, that's a new word. What's exoplanet?
Exoplanet, okay. Planet, the official definition for planet is it goes around our sun.
Goes around our sun or around any sun?
Our sun. The definition of the word planet, which is why Pluto isn't one, is that it has to go around our sun, it has to be spherical, and it has to have cleared out its orbit. Those are the three conditions to be a planet.
Okay, so this Gliese 581G is not a planet because it doesn't go around our sun.
Yeah, it's an exoplanet, which is a planet going around any other star.
Ah, okay.
So an alien planet, for want of a better term. They purposely did not even try to define planet in terms of other stars because they had trouble enough just defining it for our solar system.
I picture this committee arguing for days, months.
It wasn't days.
Years?
It was decades.
Oh, jeez.
And then when they finally did make a decision, of course, they made themselves half unpopular and half popular. Because whenever you make a decision, you annoy half the people and you please half the people.
That's what amazes me, that the Declaration of Independence of the United States stands. It's like, how on earth did a committee of people come up with that? And it worked, you know.
That's true, actually. It's one of the rare examples of that.
Pretty astonishing. Anyway.
So anyway, back to Gliese.
Okay.
So it's a planet in the Goldilocks zone, but it's not really like the Earth. It's quite different to the Earth in a couple of ways. Apart from being three times as heavy, it's also much, 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 much closer to its star than we are to our sun.
Oh.
Six times closer. And that gives you an idea of how much less bright these little red dwarfs are compared to our sun.
Because it can be that close and yet be...
Because it has to be that close to be in the Goldilocks zone.
Oh, okay.
Whereas we're smack dab in the middle of our Goldilocks zone, and we're sitting out here six times further away.
Yeah.
And heat falls off. Is it as or cubed or as or squared?
Squared.
Heat? I thought gravity fell off squared and heat is cubed.
I thought they were all squared, but I could be wrong.
Either way, six times closer is 36 times, is 6 to the power of 6 times dimmer, probably, rather than...
Mm-hmm.
It's not linear at all. So 6 times closer means way, 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 way less bright.
Right, right.
Now, because it's so close, that also has another effect. So it has to be that close because that's where the heat is in such a dim little star. But if you're close in, you also orbit faster. So its quote-unquote year is a whopping 37 days.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I'm deadly serious. It's 37
days. 37 days. So it's going fast.
Yeah, it has to. Like Mercury. Mercury goes a lot faster than us because the closer in you are, the quicker you go.
Sure.
You have to go, because when you're in orbit, what you're really doing is you're going fast enough forward to counteract falling into the star. Mm-hmm. So when you're so close, being pulled so hard, you got to go pretty fast forward not to fall in.
Is it hard to stand up on a planet that 37 days is a year?
No.
I would think you'd be bent over.
No, you're in the same frame of reference, so you don't have any idea that the Earth is going at many hundreds of thousands of kilometers a second around the center of the Milky Way and so on and so forth, because we're all in the same inertial frame of reference.
I'm over here doing cartoon physics in my head.
there we go. It's relativity for you.
There you go.
Got to know Albert Einstein. So being close in means that you're going very fast and you have a very short year. But when you get close enough for long enough, something happens. It's called tidal locking. And we have a very good example of it very, very close to home. You probably noticed that every time you look at the moon, it has the same craters facing us.
Yeah.
It's a big sphere. It has twice as many craters as we can see. There's the whole back of it. But its same side is always facing us. As the time it takes to rotate once on its axis is the same amount of time exactly as it takes to go once around the Earth. So it's rolling around in such a way that the same face is always facing us.
Now, you see different ones than I do?
No.
Wait, well, we can't. Oh, I see what you're saying. Everybody always sees the same one. So the dark side of the moon is always the dark side of the moon?
No, it's not the dark side. It's the far side. Because all sides get lit. Because as it's going around the Earth, the sun is sitting over to one side. So you still get full moon, half moon, new moon, full moon, half moon, new moon, and so on.
Sorry, I was being center of the universe again.
Yeah, but we in the Earth always see the exact same side of the moon. Because it's tidally locked with us.
Why did I not know that? It's kind of sad that I never caught on to that.
There you go. Mercury is also, it was also assumed to be tidally locked. It probably isn't, but we used to think it was.
So what's the phrase again?
Tidally locked.
Tidally locked. Why does it refer to the tides in that?
It's because, I could explain, but it would take a long time.
Okay. All right. I'll let you get back on topic.
Because of how close and how big the planet is, because it's three times the weight of the mass of the Earth, remember, and it's in very close, six times closer than us, we're pretty sure it's tidally locked too.
Oh.
So GJ581G always has the same side facing its star, which means that there is a little less than half of the planet where it's always daytime, a little less than half the planet where it's always nighttime, and then a rim in between where it's always twilight.
Okay.
So what that potentially is quite interesting from a biological point of view, because it means every possible habitat's there. If you need colder, you just go a little further around the back.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need warmer, you go a little further around the front. And between the back and the front, you've got a nice variation in temperatures, so you're pretty much bound to get what you need.
Okay.
So that's an interesting little feature of it. It would lead to very different weather to what we're used to, because the sun would be driving one side of the atmosphere and not driving the other side of the atmosphere at all. So it could be a very interesting place, but yeah, certainly not Earth-like in that way.
Hmm.
But nonetheless, it is possible that life exists there. We have no evidence for it, but it is possible, and that in itself is quite special.
So we've never found a planet that fits this criteria, being in the Goldilocks zone, not a gas giant. Just those two criteria?
We haven't had anything that fits us perfectly. We may have had a couple that sort of get one or two of these things. We've only discovered about 490, I think it was 491 extrasolar planets in total.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Remember, the first one was discovered in 1992.
Really? The first exoplanet?
The first exoplanet was discovered in 1992. This is an immensely new branch of physics.
I had no idea.
And our detection mechanisms are very strongly biased towards finding big. It's easy to find. It's easier. It's always hard, but it's easier to find big planets than little planets.
That's surprising to me. All you people looking in them telescopes all these years, you just found them?
But it's because it's so immensely difficult. You are looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. A star shines so bright, and planets, as seen from us, are so physically close that you can't really distinguish them from the glare of their parent star, that they're completely outshined. It's like trying to see the light of a candle or a firefly in the beam of a lighthouse.
Okay, right.
And the firefly is like an inch from the lighthouse. You know, it is immensely difficult to do. And to be honest, it's surprising we've managed to do it at all, let alone that, you know, we've managed to find almost 500 of them in the space of 22 years.
So some technology must have come in that allowed us to do that.
Exactly. So we've been improving the technique. So I thought it might be nice actually to talk about how we do this.
Yeah.
The first method, and it's still the most used method, is called the Doppler method. And it uses our good old friend, the Doppler shift.
I love the Doppler shift.
So if you have a star and you have a planet, the two of them are in orbit. We like to think of it as being simply the case that the planet orbits the star and the star sits still. That's not true of any orbital system. What actually happens is both objects rotate around their common center of gravity. If they were about the same size, then the center of gravity would be in the middle. But the heavy object pulls the center of gravity towards it, so in the case of a star and a planet, the center of gravity is immensely close to the center of the star, probably even within the surface of the star.
Okay.
But it's still orbiting around that center of gravity rather than orbiting than sitting still. So the planet makes the star wobble.
Oh, okay.
Very slightly.
Makes sense.
So you can think of it as the planet pulling against the star so it wobbles.
Right.
But really the two of them are circling around that common center of gravity.
Okay.
So if you watch the star, if something is wobbling, it moves away from you 1 minute and towards you the next minute and away from you 1 minute and toward, well, not 1 minute, one
cycle. Yeah.
Which could be 37 days in the case of this planet.
Oh, so if it's wobbling, you know something's making it wobble.
Exactly.
If it was a star with no planets, it would just go around its own center of gravity, which would be the center of the star.
Well, it would just sit there. Yeah, exactly. Its center of gravity would be its own center, and that would be that.
It would spin on its own axis.
Yeah.
If it spun at all. But yeah, okay. All right, so it's wobbling. So how do we know it's wobbling?
So we look at the light coming off the star, and we measure its color very carefully. And at the moment it's wobbling towards us, the light will be slightly more blue. And at the moment it's wobbling away from us, the light will be slightly more red.
Can I take a shot at explaining why that is?
Of course you can, and I bet you're going to mention ambulances.
I'll go fire trucks then. No,
fire trucks. Okay.
So what's happening is the energy that's coming off of it basically gets compressed as it comes towards us and gets spread out as it goes away. So blue must be a higher frequency of light and red must be lower frequency. So the waves are getting compressed together, making a higher frequency coming towards us and wider apart or lower frequency as it goes away. So red is a lower frequency.
Exactly. Yeah, the difference, the distance between the peaks of red light is longer than the distance between the peaks of blue light.
So that what Bart was going to say about the ambulance, when you hear an ambulance coming towards you, the sound is higher than when it's going away. It gets up higher and higher as it comes towards you, and then it starts to slow down as it goes away. And that's the audio frequency going lower as it goes away.
Yeah. And in the case of audio waves, the waves are being compressed as the ambulance is going towards you, so it's higher pitch, and then being stretched as the ambulance is moving away from you, so it's the lower pitch. You go, dee-no.
So you can kind of think of it as like a boat coming towards you, compressing the water in front of it, making little tiny waves as it comes towards you. And as it goes away, those waves spread back out.
Sort of, except it should be a boat emitting waves and then catching up with its own waves.
Okay, but boats
don't. Because the star is emitting
waves.
The light, and then it's catching up with itself or running away from
it. And they're actually emitting the waves at the exact same frequency as they come towards you and go away. It's just that because the distance is shortening, it has to shrink up.
Yeah, so the star is the same color, but as it moves away and back and away and back, it oscillates around that real color, going a little too red, a little too blue, a little too red, a little too blue. So if you measure it very carefully and you graph it, you will see the effect of the planet. And every different planet in the system will add another wave on top of the wave. And so if you get a detailed enough curve, you'll see the different sine waves that are superimposed together to make the funny-looking wave you see, which is where you begin to pick out the biggest planet first because it's going to be the most dominant wave. And then as you look at the signal more carefully, you'll start to pick out more and more and more, which is what's happened here where they've gotten to six.
Wait, you've lost me. So all I know is that the star is wobbling because it's going blue, red, blue, red, blue, red.
Mm-hmm.
Second star planet change it?
It goes blue, red, blue, red, but instead of being a nice, simple sine wave, it's what you get when you add up two sine waves.
Wait a minute, though. The center of gravity is just the center of gravity, even though you've got
there's
six...
There's lots of centers of gravity in the system.
Not for the star. The star's only got one.
Yes, the star. No, there's six objects orbiting this star, so there's six centers of gravity in play, so the star is sort of wobbling between them all.
But they average down to one, I thought you said they average down to one. So like when you had one star and one
planet. In the simple case, the way you understand that is the simple case, one star, one planet, and then both of them make perfect circles.
Okay.
So a little teeny tiny circle for the star and a massive big circle for the planet.
Right.
But when you have lots of planets, each of those planets are making an approximate circle that isn't a perfect circle. And the star is being pushed and pulled by all of them. So it makes a very erratic movement, which when you plot it, is the superposition of the simple movements it would make if there were only one planet.
So all you're going to be able to measure, though, is that graph, that two-axis graph. So how do you know where three things are pointing?
It's going to be a two-axis graph, which is going to be a very odd-looking shape.
But if it's got six separate peaks, that's how you know there's six planets?
It's not six separate peaks. What you do is something called a Fourier transform on it, which will break any wave into the component sine waves that make it up. And each of those sine waves is a planet.
I used to know how to do Fourier transforms, but that was a long time ago.
You do them in physics all the time.
Right.
So if you add up all the sine waves together, you get the funny wibbly-wobbly wave that you will actually observe with your telescope. And we have the math to go backwards from a funny wibbly-wobbly wave to multiple sine waves. And each sine wave is what you'll get for a planet.
So does the sine wave give you any indication of once you've separated those six sine waves now, does that give you some indication of where the planets are?
It gives you the speed. It gives you the period. And the period with orbital mechanics gives you the distance because not all orbits are possible. If you're going at a certain speed, you have to be at a certain distance.
From that star?
Yeah.
Not from us, but from the star?
From what you're orbiting around. So the orbital mechanics, you can't be a certain size and going at a certain speed and not be in a certain place. The orbital mechanics don't allow for every possible solution. They only allow for set solutions to equations.
So now I'm picturing
If you know the period, you can work back and get the other terms in the icky equation. There's some really nasty maths goes on in this. Really nasty maths.
I'm glad we're not going to go into that. But so now I'm picturing that because of the shape of the sine wave, we now know how far away it is from the planet. But do we know how that orbit is oriented versus our view of that planet? Like if it's edge on, that orbit could be just straight up and down.
Well, it will distort the sine waves, if you think about it.
Okay.
If it's a perfect sine wave, then it's at a perfect...
circle coming at us?
Right angle to us. It's perfectly in our plane of view. But if you start to tilt it, then it's not a perfect sine wave. It's a slightly distorted sine wave.
Wow.
So you start to work in those math, too, to get the tilt of the whole system relative to us. it's really nasty maths. And the hard part is to have data that's clean enough to do the maths on. So you got to keep observing and observing and observing so that your error bars become tinier and tinier and tinier, and you have a more and more accurate plot. And once you have what you think is an accurate plot, then you can do the math.
So once you've done all that math and you know what that orbit is, how do you find the planet?
Well, the planet pops straight out of the math.
Okay, you know, so the planet's there because of the math. You still can't see it.
You physically can't see it, no, because
it's the firefly
in the lighthouse.
Okay, so it's sort of like you just know by the effect that it's there.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay.
So the bigger the planet is relative to its... The bigger the planet is and the closer it is to the star, the bigger its sine wave is going to be and the easier it's going to be to pull out of the data.
Hmm.
So you need to have... So if you have big error bars, you're still going to see a big planet 10 times the size of Jupiter at about the distance of Mercury. Your error bars can be pretty substantial and that signal will still come through because it's a really strong signal. But to find something like this that's only 3 times the size of the Earth, and now it's close, but it's, you know, still only a sixth of the way,
mm-hmm.
that means you need to have really good data. And you need to have been working on it for many years to be absolutely sure of your data. And because the longer you observe, of course, the more signal you have and the less noise you have.
Okay.
So it's really difficult to find things like this. So what they're doing now is they're really pushing this Doppler method to its limits.
Cool.
Yeah. So the Doppler method is the first thing we discovered. It's the first way we discovered a planet. The very first planets in 1992 were done using the Doppler method, and we still do it. It's a good method. But it's biased towards big, heavy planets, and everyone's interested in Earth-like planets.
Right, we can find all these gas giants, but we don't care.
Exactly. So we're now looking at new methods for finding Earth-like planets. And the most successful method in that regard is the transit method. This cannot find every possible planet out there. It can only find a subset of planets which are lined up in such a way that their solar system is edge-on to us, and which means that the planets will go between us and their star.
Okay.
And so what happens is, when the planet moves in front of the star, the parent star dims by like 0.0001 of a percent, but it dims nonetheless. And if you draw the light curve, an eclipse like this has a really distinct shape. So you'll have a perfectly flat line, then down, then a perfectly flat line, then up and back to your original level.
So it's up when the planet is on the opposite side?
So when the planet is anywhere except for in front of the star, so it can be a little to the left, it can be behind it, it can be a little to the right. So for 99% of its orbit, it's not blocking any light at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the star is its full brightness. Then the planet moves in front of the star, and because the planet is small and the star is big, it'll be a very quick drop. It won't be perfectly straight line, but it'll be a very quick drop off.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take long for the whole star to be in front. Then it'll travel across the face of the star, so you'll have a low level where it'll be flat. And then it'll come out at the edge, and it'll very quickly go back up to its original level. And if you see that exact shape, that very distinctive shape in your graph, happening with a regular period, you have a planet.
So... forgive me if I'm being incredibly uneducated in astronomy, but if you have one planet that's in a plane that's edge on to us like that, does mm-hmm. that mean all planets that revolve around that are in that same plane, or they're going around different planes?
They're going to be close to it. They're going to be close to it.
Okay.
Because the way planets form is from a spinning disk of dust, which, because it's spinning, it naturally flattens.
Okay.
It's like if you spin pancake dough, it flattens.
Right, right. Actually, so I think you spin pizza dough, not pancake dough.
Pizza dough, that's the one, yeah.
Don't try it with pancake dough. That would be a bit of a mess.
How do you even hold that up? But yeah, so because the planets are made from spinning disks of gas and dust, they're all very, very much on the same plane. They might be off by 1% or 2%,
okay,
but they're very, very close together.
I should have known that one too, but now I do, because I'll keep picturing the pancake dough. Okay.
Oops. So the transit method means you have to measure the brightness of stars very accurately, very often.
Right.
So you need to watch them nightly. In fact, more than nightly, because a transit may only take an hour or two.
Oh, okay. And the transit is when it's switching from behind. Okay.
Yeah, a transit. So we get them in our solar system. We have transits of Venus and Mercury, because from where we're sitting, they can pass between us and the sun.
Okay.
And then you literally see a black dot moving across the sun. I observed one a couple of years ago. It was quite good fun, actually.
Ooh, not with the naked eye.
No. very simple, very, very, very cheap telescope projecting back onto a sheet of paper.
Oh, neat.
And we did it outside the physics building in the college so that students walking by could pop in and have a look. It was nice. It was a good day.
Cool.
So if you measure these transits, you need to do it. It's very difficult because you have to measure very, very accurately. We're talking about a significantly less than 1% drop in brightness. So you need to have really good photometers, they're called, for measuring the brightness. You need to calibrate them very well. So the way you calibrate them is you have a guide star, so that you have a star of a known brightness and you use that to calibrate your equipment, and then you check the star you're interested in following. And that way, if there's a slight difference in the atmosphere or whatever, it won't throw all your measurements out because, you know, a little more dust, some volcano went off somewhere, it'll change your measurements.
Hmm.
So we have actually two satellites in orbit around the Earth doing this. And because they're a satellite, they have a much better chance of doing it because the atmosphere isn't messing things up for them.
Right.
So the first one was launched in 2007, and it's a European mission called COROT, C-O-R-O-T. And so far, it's found 14 planets.
Wow.
But it's sort of a pioneer, so it's testing the technology. But this year, very recently, NASA launched a satellite called Kepler.
Hmm.
And Kepler is going to do this type of measurement on 13.2 million stars.
Jeez.
So they've pre-picked the stars it's going to do. And every night, it basically has fiber optic equipment so that it just points at a whole block of the sky and the fiber optic bits are pointed at all the right stars it wants to measure.
Mm.
And so it just funnels back like 1,000 stars at a time.
Wow.
And does all of those measurements. And then it moves on to another part of the sky and does it again. And all day it just rotates around its catalog. And so we have very regular measurements of 13.2 million stars. It's just constantly checking each one, check. And it checks them loads of stars at a time, not one by one.
So what we're talking about here is its entire purpose.
Its entire purpose is to find Earth-like planets. And it's going to be up there for, I think it's 5 years. And of those 13.2 million stars, that's a big enough number to be statistically important. 13.2 million really allows us to draw conclusions from the data. If they don't find a single Earth-like star in 13.2 million stars, that's a significant negative find. That means that the Earth is very rare.
Hmm.
Doesn't mean it's unique, but it certainly means it's not a dime a dozen.
No,
expecting to find 50.
Really?
According to current theories, they're expecting to find 50 because it will only find Earth-like stars that pass in front of the star.
Earth-like planets, planets
it'll find all planets
stars,
that pass in front of the star. So it's only they're interested in 50 Earth-likes is what they're expecting. They're going to find hundreds, probably thousands of planets.
But ones that are Earth-like, you're saying down to the 50?
Yeah, so they're going to pick up big planets, little planets, you name it. But they're expecting 50 Earths. So within the next few years, we are going to have some very important results.
So
very interesting times.
That is really cool. Now, why wouldn't the Hubble have already been doing this? Because it wasn't designed
to do it? Because Hubble isn't suited to it. Hubble is not suited to that job at all.
Wrong kind of optics? Wrong kind of...
Wrong optics, wrong everything. Hubble is designed to do wide field work.
Okay.
And it's designed to stare at one patch of the sky for days on end to give you insane amounts of detail. Like those famous Hubble deep field images where you can see galaxies into forever.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like 19-day exposures.
Oh, wow.
So Hubble does the long stare thing.
So did Kepler find the Gliese 581G?
No. Gliese 581G was found using the good old-fashioned Doppler method.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah. All the Gliese systems have been found. All the Gliese 581, so B, C, D, E, F, and G, were all found using Doppler.
So they just got lucky finding one of the right kind.
Well, yes, because it's a star that's very close to us.
Right.
Which means the closer the star is to us, the easier these Doppler-type measurements are.
Hmm.
Another very cool way that it hasn't really brought up many results yet because it's very new, but the concept of gravitational lensing is another way to look for planets. So if you have something very heavy like a star, it bends light just like a lens does. So if there's something behind the star as seen from us, then we can see the bending of the light by the star on the thing behind.
Because if its gravitational pull is pulling on the light?
Yep.
Wow.
Well, no, the gravity is bending space and the light is traveling in what it thinks is a straight line through the bent space.
Okay, I was really good right up until then. You finally did make my head hurt.
You've seen the diagram with the sheets of rubber where you drop the heavy things in it to simulate gravity.
Yeah.
If you draw a straight line on that rubber, that's the path light will take. But since the rubber is bent by the big heavy star, the straight line from the point of view of the rubber is actually a bent line.
Okay.
Which is why gravity bends light. It's not that it pulls on photons, because the photons have no mass.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, so they're just following bent space.
So how does that let you see something behind it again?
Because the light is coming from behind it, so it should be coming from behind it and straight to us, but it's getting bent, so it's getting focused, like a lens focuses light. And so it will magnify what's behind it.
Hmm. So is this a new technique that hasn't been proven out yet?
Oh, no, no, we've seen gravitational lensing, but the new idea is if you look really carefully at the lensed object, if there's no distortions, then it means that the star was spherical and normal. But if there's planets there, the planets will cause distortions in the lensed image. Hmm. And they will cause mathematically definable distortions. A planet of this size in this location will cause this distortion.
Okay.
So if you measure the distortion and reverse the math, you found your planet.
Wow.
So but as I say, this is quite new, this gravitational lensing.
Yeah, maybe in a few years we'll have another lesson on that one. That one's that is still hurting my brain a little bit. But I'm glad you went into this depth for me. I guess I can see why they didn't do it in a 2-minute blurb on Tech News Today or anything like that. But this is pretty interesting. It sounds like a really, like you said, an interesting time to stay tuned.
Very much. With Kepler up there doing its magic, this really is an interesting time. The next couple of years are going to really shake things up.
Now, I know I just sent you a note saying it's time to close out, but I did have one more question.
Okay.
How much bandwidth does it require to ship the data back from Kepler back to us?
I don't know.
I wonder if it's a lot of data or a little bit of data.
It's just going to be sending back little points of light, though. So to be honest, it's not going to be that high, because it's not trying to make a pretty picture. It's just trying to measure light curves.
So it might be a text file? It's not taking photos.
It's going to be compressed. Let's face it, it's going to be compressed because bandwidth is always difficult. But it's not far away from
Earth. But it's not like it's photos that it's sending.
No, it's not like photos at all, because all you need is a two-dimensional graph showing time and brightness.
Yeah.
And that shows you the light curve. So that's all it's doing. It's sending 13.2 million graphs over 5 years.
So add up to a bit, right?
It's a bit, but it's not far away from us. I think, maybe slightly wrong here, but I think it's in one of the Lagrange points, which means it's physically very close to us in the solar system.
Okay.
So we can keep a pretty good bandwidth going if it's close. The problem is with stuff like Voyager, where it's absolutely bloody... I'll say not miles, astronomical units away.
Right.
And it has a weak transmitter, so the signal to noise goes completely belly up, and it's all noise and almost no signal. So your speed of transmission has to go down if your noise goes up.
And the complexity of that data being sent is a lot higher than what this is going to be sending to us, sounds like.
Exactly. So something like Voyager trickles its data back, but something like this that's just sending us straightforward graphs, it should be fine because it's close to us. I don't think it's going to have an issue. It's not all going to be like the Large Hadron Collider where we're talking terabytes a second. It's not that kind of experiment.
Cool. Well, Bart, thanks for taking the time to explain that to me. I hope other people were curious as well and wondering what this what the hoopla was about. We might have gotten a little bit deep, but I don't know. I didn't feel like my head went under at any point till the very end there.
Well, you told me to explain. So.
I did. I did. That's exactly what I was hoping for.
For listeners, there's also quite a few links to Wikipedia articles in the show notes if you want to dig a little deeper.
Yep. Good job.
Okay. I guess we're calling it quits for now then. So,
I think so.
Until next time, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for this week. But remember, the next time someone says the iPad isn't magical, tell them about Pat's amazing son. I hope sometime soon you can make it to the live show. I can tell you there was not a dry eye in the house tonight talking about Pat's son. All you have to do is point your browser to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Sunday nights, and the Nosilla Castaways will walk you through how to do everything else. In the meantime, give me a holler and email at allison@podfeet.com with your dumb questions and comments. Also, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.